think Ireland at the moment is trying to strike that balance between respecting and honouring things like the Irish language, which is coming back with a vengeance at the moment and is becoming a very trendy thing to be involved with, you know, and very kind of old Irish, but then also bring forward very new elements. I would hope that that continues and that reflects and moves forward to special education provision in Ireland.
I'm Tracy Spencer Walsh, and this is the It's Special podcast, a podcast for you to overhear my conversations with top professionals in the world of special needs and law and civil rights. We are curating information about special children's rights and distilling it into bite-sized pieces for all to enjoy. We have Orla Mannion here today joining us from Dublin, Ireland. Orla, how are you today?
I'm not too bad, thanks, Tracy. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. We have Orla here today who's going to speak with us about what it is like for children with disabilities in Ireland and their education system. And Orla and I were speaking about this prior to today, and I thought that I would just give a little bit of background about the United States and how our government system works here. And here in the United States, we have a federalist system comprised of a national government and individual state governments, which I'm sure many of the people listening here today already know that. We have 50 states, as you know, and therefore we also have 50 individual state governments. And these smaller political subdivisions have the power to make laws, and both have a certain level of autonomy from each other. The United States government was designed to prevent any one person from having all authority, like the King of England at the time. The founding fathers were fearful of having too strong of a national government, fearing a despot regime, and they created a system where the national government has no power in certain state issues. Likewise, they recognized that the country did need an overall leadership and designated certain powers only to the national government, which all state citizens must abide by. So the federal, or also known as the national government in the United States, has exclusive authority in certain areas. For example, the making of treaties with foreign governments. Only our federal government can do that. We also have three co-equal branches of government: the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, and each branch provides what we call a checks and balances on their co-equal counterparts. We also have two chambers that comprise Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the number of representatives is determined by a state's population, which is why the census is so important in this country. Because depending on the population will determine the number of representatives that will go to the House of Representatives. So states with a larger population are more represented in the House of Representatives. Well, the small states at the time of the formation of our country were concerned that the large states would have too much power over decision making and their smaller states' voices would go unheard. So in our Senate chamber, every state in our country has two senators. So we have 100 senators, two from every state. And that was for the purpose of ensuring that even the small states had an equal voice in our legislative branch of government. And Congress makes laws. Our judicial branch interprets laws. And Congress can rewrite the law to ensure that it complies with the U.S. Constitution in the event that the judicial branch strikes down a law. And then in our executive branch, if Congress passes a law, the executive, the president of the United States, can veto that law. Then that decision can be overridden by the Congress by two-thirds vote, which we call a supermajority vote. So I give this background because we're going to talk about how the government works in Ireland with respect to special education students. And for those listening to us today, we have a federal statute in this country called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And that federal statute, by virtue of the fact that it is a federal statute, applies and is applicable to all 50 states. So every state in the United States must follow the mandate of the IDEA, which is the acronym for the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Once there is a federal law that applies to the states, states may also enact their own laws with respect to that subject area. So in this case, it's the education of children with disabilities. But they can't reduce the rights or the benefits that the federal law has given to children with disabilities. So there are states that can expand on those rights, but no state can diminish those rights. So there will be states in the union, in our country, that will have their own education laws. And again, they either can mirror what the federal statute calls for or expand upon it, but cannot minimize it. So this is a very important law and statute in our country, and it is what gives students the right in this country, students with a classifiable disability, the right to what we call a free, appropriate public education, otherwise known as a FAPE. So, Orla, can you tell us a little bit about how the government system works in Ireland?
Sure, absolutely. Well, just to give a quick overview, we have our separation of powers and our three branches of government. So we have our legislature, our judicial branch, and our executive. So our legislative branch is the Oireachtas and the Dáil, which encompasses our president of Ireland, our lower house, or our parliament, if you will. We have our Seanad, which is the same as the Senate. You know, those three branches together, basically the Dáil, the Seanad, are in charge of creating law. And then we have our executive, which is the government, and then we have our judiciary, which is the courts. You know, I suppose our constitution is the main provision of fundamental rights in Ireland and our different protections. Also, as part of the EU, we also have, you know, different EU regulations and directives and rules that we follow as well. So actually, interestingly enough, I suppose EU law for most areas would have primacy over Irish law. So, you know, a lot of our rules and standards that we kind of build our legislation towards would come from the EU as well. Yeah, so just our different branches of government would have different names and would be referred to differently than perhaps other countries. But we, you know, ultimately have a constitution, we have a parliamentary republic, we have checks and balances, we have a separation of powers, we use a common law system, so similar to the US and to the United Kingdom. Yeah, and I suppose, you know, Ireland is a relatively kind of new republic. We had our final constitution finalized in 1937, but we weren't officially declared a republic until 1949, I believe. That's a rough overview of the Irish government and how those three branches work and interact with each other.
Well, thank you for that background. And I know that some of the terminology you're using are words from the Irish language. And I just want our listeners to know that we will have a glossary available on our website where you can look up those words so that you can understand the word that Orla was using. And you know what? Now that we're talking about that, Orla, let's circle back a little bit to just some history for our listeners to understand. We're talking about the Republic of Ireland, which is different from Northern Ireland. And I think many people today don't realize that Ireland and Northern Ireland physically share the same island. And when I say island, I mean I-S-L-A-N-D. And so can you give us a little background about that and what the differences are between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland?
For sure. So essentially, Northern Ireland is considered to be part of the United Kingdom. And we share the same island, as Tracy has said, but we are considered to be different countries. So I think really kind of the quickest and simplest way to describe it is that, you know, Ireland was a whole country and nation, and then we were occupied by the United Kingdom. And then there was kind of in the early 1900s, there was a war of independence. You know, between the space of 20 years, there was then an Anglo-Irish treaty agreed, which essentially separated the north of Ireland from the south of Ireland. And the south of Ireland became a republic and Northern Ireland kind of amalgamated and became its own entity as part of the United Kingdom. And in Northern Ireland now, I think, you know, I was looking up statistics recently, and I think 23% of people from living in Northern Ireland identify as nationalists, which means that they consider themselves to be from the Republic, to be part of the same island. And then we have 33% that would consider themselves to be unionists. So they would very much want and hope for the continued separation from the Republic and to continue being part of the United Kingdom. But then interestingly enough, you know, more and more within recent times, the number of people who actually don't feel kind of pushed one way or another would be kind of closer to 40%, people who would identify as neither unionist or nationalist and would just, you know, wouldn't question their identity too deeply.
That's interesting. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It is interesting. So do you have a written constitution in the Republic of Ireland?
I absolutely do. Our constitution is, we consider it to be, you know, a living, breathing document. So it's something that's alive and it's continued to be read into and understood because we have the existence of, within the constitution, it's a very comprehensive document. It covers everything from how the government is formulated to giving the right to education. But we also have things called unenumerated rights as well within it. You know, so we have occasionally the courts will read into it and be able to infer a right to something that perhaps isn't explicitly written, but is understood to cover it and kind of provide for it. So, and that's kind of why part of the reason why it's considered to be a living, breathing document, because there's always the potential for new things to be read into it.
And remember, I might ask you questions. I don't expect you to have all the answers, but some of the things that I pick up on, I guess what I was going to ask you is, do you know, is the Irish constitution based on any other type of constitution? Do you know if it's based on the British constitution? Well, the British constitution is unwritten, but the United States constitution is written.
Right. I know that there was, I think it's 1922, the kind of first iteration of a constitution was released. And this was before Ireland became a republic. So really, it didn't hold the same power that the one that we currently use did. And I really feel that it was very reflective of Ireland at the time. You know, there was a lot of great political minds that sat down and they really went over it and decided for it to reflect Irish society as it existed. So I'm sure there was inspiration taken, you know, from other documents in other countries, including the US. But it is also very much reflective of Irish society, especially as I said, as it existed at the time. We would have a lot of different aspects of the constitution that would be considered to be out of touch, out of time. And the only way for the constitution to be changed is for it to be under referendum. So the population of Ireland would vote to change it, which has happened quite recently in the past couple of years. We've had the appeal referendum, which was repealing the 8th, which was an amendment covering abortion. And we've also had basically where same-sex marriage in Ireland became legalized. And I think we were the first country in the world to do that by a democratic vote rather than have the government or a different party install that as legal.
Yes, the Republic of Ireland certainly has become progressive compared to what it used to be like, and certainly what I remember hearing about Ireland in the 70s and 80s and I guess even the 90s. So lots of changes there. One of the things I picked up on you saying, Orla, is that in your constitution there is a right to education. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So the right to education in the constitution in Ireland has been incredibly important for, you know, essentially children accessing the right to education. I suppose what's interesting about how it's written is that, unfortunately, it's only applicable for primary schools. So there is a right to education, but it only goes as far as primary, which would be, I suppose, the equivalent of elementary school. Primary school is kind of guaranteed until the age of around 11 years old in Ireland. You know, there's a lot of language in the constitution regarding education in terms of, you know, it speaks a lot to the family being, you know, the primary provider and parents, you know, having a lot of power basically in how their child is able to access that education. You would find very little reference, if any at all, to an adult within education, which is something that has caused a little bit of debate as well, because it's so particular to the child. But of course, education is something that we should all be able to avail of our whole lives. We also, it's interesting because there is a case, it's called the Sinnott case, and it was where someone who was 23 years old, I believe, and they'd only had 2 years of primary school education at the time, that their case was brought to the High Court in Ireland and basically said, it's not good enough that my son hasn't received an appropriate level of primary school education. So even though he's an adult now, he should still have the right to access it. And the High Court basically said, you're absolutely right. He can have access to it for as long as he's able to, and as long as he's able to benefit from it. But unfortunately, with that case, it was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically said you can only access primary school education until the age of 18. Primary school education is not for adults to benefit from. So that's very much entrenched now within the Constitution, that, you know, the right to primary school education is acknowledged. It's very important. It exists. It's, you know, because there's such a lack of maybe other statutory protections, it's crucial that we have that written down. But it's still a right that does have limitations on it too.
So with respect to what happens with educating children with disabilities, just a little bit of background for our readers. Orla used to work in my office when she was living here in the United States and is very well versed and familiar with the IDEA. Is there anything like that in Ireland, Orla?
Well, it's funny because I remember when I came back to Ireland and I decided to do my master's and kind of research that, the first thing that I looked for was, what's the equivalent to the IDEA Act, and do we have a FAPE, essentially a free appropriate primary education? Do we have that entitlement? And it was very difficult to find any information on it. So I would say the closest thing that we would have to the IDEA Act would be something called the EPSON Act, and that's the Education of Persons with Special Educational Needs. And that was put together in 2004. And it was very much seen as a response to a lot of high profile constitutional litigation, where families were fighting for the right for their children with special educational needs to have also an equal access to primary education. If the EPSON Act was to be implemented tomorrow, there would be huge change in Ireland. For example, we would suddenly have a statutory entitlement to IEPs. There would be a much easier way for families, instead of having to resort to going to the courts, which is a very expensive process in Ireland, particularly when we don't have specialised courts for education. It's going basically straight to the High Court and then to the Supreme Court. The EPSON Act would have established a tribunal, especially, you know, designed for dealing with families very quickly and with a lot of ease. It was also very much designed with the kind of human rights model of disability in mind, and it was very much a step away from the medical model. So there's huge benefits, and it was really classed as a monumental piece of legislation, but it was, you know, passed in 2004, and I think something like 2/3 of it have yet to be implemented. And considering we're now heading very much into 2022, it just seems like it's probably out of date anyway, even if it was to be implemented today. And it certainly was very disappointing for me, because of having worked with you and looked at the IDEA Act, and then to suddenly come home and realise we really were very behind in what we had to offer.
So you use the term IEPs, and just for our listeners, I just want to clarify that that is an individualised education plan, which students in this country who have classifiable disabilities can have. So it would be a plan that is intended to be designed to meet a student's individual educational needs in a public school system. Now, there's so many things that I can touch on with you, Orla, because there's just so much material for us to cover. So, I mean, I'm going to try to keep this as organized as possible. So when we're talking about IEPs and we're talking about statutes, and you mentioned the EPSON Act and how that really hasn't manifested quite as it was intended to. Like I said earlier in this interview, in the United States, we're comprised of 50 states, and we have the state governments and we have a national government. Now, I know in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, there are 26 counties. And so do those 26 counties, is it similar to the states where they have their own laws, or all 26 counties follows the Republic of Ireland, the national government's laws?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be very much, they would all follow the national government. And I suppose it's even interesting, that's a really great question, I think, and how that kind of becomes quite evident as well in Ireland, that how kind of all the counties follow, you know, the same rules, is that even when election time comes around, it's so localised in Ireland. So we have, I'm not sure what the numbers would be, but we have an inordinate amount of independent parties that come forward and put themselves forward at election time. I think much more so than you would find in other countries. And they do extremely well, because in Ireland, because everything is so, I suppose, yeah, localised across the entire country, and it's a small country too, that everyone knows everyone and everyone follows the same rules. And you could have an independent party, or a TD, as we would say, in Roscommon, and they might speak to issues that would affect someone in Cork, and they're probably going to do very well in terms of getting elected to government, because they can kind of count on their local community. And I suppose so in that way, we would be very localized, very much the same across the country in terms of how the rules and the law would be implemented.
And when you say it's a small country, are you about 5 million people? Do you know what the population is currently?
Yeah, I think it's between 4 and 5 million, something like that. So,
compared to the United States, which is, I don't know, I think it's about 325 million people. So I guess comparatively, there is a big difference with respect to population. And we have many Irish immigrants who have come here over the years for a variety of reasons, including my grandparents, by the way. As I think you know, both of my grandparents on my mother's side were born in Dublin, Ireland, and came to this country, you know what, during the Spanish flu, actually. So during the last global pandemic we had was when my grandparents emigrated from Ireland to New York City. But with respect to the laws and how they're applied, is there any type of guarantee with respect to a type of educational program? Or, you know, you use the word IEPs, I think, when you were talking about having worked here. Is there any type of document that's similar, that's drafted for children with disabilities in Ireland?
Well, we would have IEPs as well. We would actually refer to them the same. It's just unfortunate that they're not guaranteed. You know, it's something, if maybe your school is open to the idea of doing it for you, that's great. But because the EPSON Act hasn't been commenced, or that section of it hasn't been, it's not something that you have an entitlement to, which is such a shame. And I mean, you know, kind of looking broadly outwards with the EU, there's a big change in Ireland really within the last kind of, you know, maybe 10 years or so. Because I think we have the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities from the United Nations. And I think every country now within the EU has signed this and ratified it. But Ireland, unfortunately, signed it in 2008 and didn't actually ratify it until 2018. And the CRPD would definitely have a lot of different entitlements under it. It would, you know, specify quite clearly what it expects to see within a special education context. And it's really been, you know, a driving force for Ireland, because with such a lack of legislation ourselves, we're kind of looking now, we've agreed to bring ourselves in line with the convention, and it hasn't really happened yet. So, well, I suppose, you know, that EU element is really important, you know, in having this vacuum. And actually, that's something that I would have looked at extensively as well, just in terms of, we had a case, it was the TD versus the Minister for Education, and there was a lot of interesting elements that came out of that. But one of them was asking, where the courts basically said, when there's a vacuum in something that's a constitutionally significant area, are we allowed to fill the vacuum? Essentially, if the executive and the legislative branch of government have done nothing to provide or plan or create policy in an area that really is, you know, has a constitutional right involved, can we fill the gap? And the answer is no, but that it's kind of happened anyway. I mean, the voices of the courts in Ireland have absolutely been amplified with, again, that kind of vacuum of where legislation and coherent policy is meant to exist. So the convention is, yeah, just really important in filling those gaps for us as well.
And I think I remember reading that the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that you were just discussing mandates the implementation of an inclusion model of education. Can you speak to that at all and what that means for Ireland and the other members of the EU?
Right, absolutely. So in Ireland in the 1990s, we were, you know, kind of catching up. We had been one of the last countries in the EU to kind of do any work at all in kind of understanding, developing our understanding of special education. So I think the integrative model, which is different to the inclusion model, was kind of developing in prominence across the world, really, but particularly with the EU. And that model was basically where it kind of judged its success from, if you had a child with special educational needs and you placed them in a mainstream environment, that was kind of seen to be a success. Whereas the inclusive model is much more, it's basically centered in, yes, it, you know, it's trying to have a child with additional needs in a mainstream setting, but it is absolutely crucial that that child is given the tools for success. So you can't just, you know, pull back and say, you know, you're not going to get any additional support if you need it. That was kind of much more of an older way of viewing things. So the inclusive model is basically just having the path of least resistance in the classroom, but also making sure that everything needed is there to elevate a child's ability to do well in school. And that's also very much called for in the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And that's the reason that Ireland now has to implement that inclusion model, because it's stipulated within that convention. And we haven't really done that yet either. We're still very much using what are called special schools, which are also important, absolutely, but not as a first resort.
Well, that was the purpose of the IDEA and its previous law, the Education of People with Handicapped Act, is to make sure that special education in this country is not a place, but rather it is a program of services for a child. So prior to these very important legislative acts in our country, oftentimes, inappropriately, children with special needs were designated to a place, and that would be called going into special education, as if it was a destination. And our legislative acts were important to the whole disability community so that it was rather a program of services for children with disabilities, and they wouldn't be relegated and excluded from education or the rights to an education that perhaps a neurotypical student would have. And like you said, Orla, you know, sometimes it is appropriate for children to be in a program where they're learning alongside other children who learn like them and may have special needs. And the overarching goal here in this country is least restrictive environment to educate children to the maximum extent possible in their least restrictive environment. And of course, that varies from student to student here, and the analysis is supposed to be individualized according to that student. And when I explain this to parents that I work with, it's, you know, first and foremost, we have FAPE, we have a free, appropriate public education. And that word appropriate is an incredibly significant word, because that is what the program is supposed to be based on. Is it appropriate for the student? And sometimes appropriate means more restrictive. And it's not appropriate for the child to be in a lesser restrictive environment at that juncture of their education. So I just wanted to pick up on that, that it is important. And I'm really so glad to hear that that's also a conversation happening in Ireland with respect to special ed not being a place, but rather a constellation of services.
Absolutely. Fortunately, I think there is an awful lot of pushback in Ireland from parents and different campaigners on the inclusion model, because I think it's seen as academically, it has so many things going for it, especially considering that it falls very, you know, tightly within the human rights model of disability. But I think within Ireland, there's so much fear that because we do have this kind of legislative lacuna where there's, you know, there isn't a statutory safety net, and the courts are doing an awful lot of the policy decisions, which is very problematic. And there's, you know, not a lot of guidance from the Constitution. I mean, yes, there is the right to free primary education, but it doesn't stipulate what that implies or what a, you know, it says something about a certain minimum of education. It says nothing about this. And I think people are very worried that if the inclusion model is implemented in full in Ireland, that it's not going to be done well. So even, you know, it might sound like it would work very well, it's kind of worried that it might be seen as a, you know, a way to save money. And I definitely can see why those concerns would exist. You know, it's kind of, it is the correct model, and it's absolutely what's, especially at EU level, what's being kind of touted as the way forward, and it's something that Ireland has signed up to doing now. But I think we could certainly see problems and teething issues in the kind of implementation stage, which is is meant to already have started, and we're very slow to get to where we need to be, really.
So what would you say, Orla, is the best of what is being offered to children, to students with disabilities educationally in Ireland, if you can speak to that?
It's a really good question, and it's probably not something I can speak to too freely, except to say that I know there is a lot of passion in Ireland, and from teachers, from different schools, you know, from, it's definitely not, and certainly within the scope of what I kind of studied, it's never been seen as an issue from within the school. It's very much seen at a much broader level, at a much more government level and a legislative level, and not out of badness. And I mean, you know, kind of considering where Ireland was maybe 30 years ago, there has been huge improvement. And I know recently within the latest government budget that was announced for 2022 last month, I think 25% of the school budget has been allocated towards special education, which is huge. And so there are positive developments happening, and there is on the ground, I think there is a lot of care and a lot of love and a lot of passion. It's just the appropriate resources really need to be given to those who need them. And there's a way to go, but movement is happening, is what I would say.
And, you know, here in this country, we have a concept called compensatory education, that when a student with special needs, who, again, I use this term classifiable disability because that is within the statute, does not get the education that they were entitled to for a variety of reasons, they may be compensated with educational services on a going forward basis. So if we were to look back, there's a statute of limitations on the look back period. If you look back and see that a student did not get the services they were entitled to, they can pursue that with their school district, pursue that either in or out of a legal situation, and the student can be compensated in an effort to bring the student to where the student would have been had those services not been withheld. And I think earlier in this interview, you were talking about the case where there was a 23-year-old, and if I recall what you said correctly, that student had only had 2 years of education in his life, and when he was 23, his mother was pursuing some kind of recompense for the failure to have her son get the education he was entitled to, apparently under your constitution. But there was, it doesn't sound like there is any concept of compensating students for missed educational services. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, and I suppose from my viewpoint, there isn't within the legislation that I reviewed any sort of, you know, system of redress. However, I do know for the Senate case, there were damages awarded. And it's, I know that's, you know, it's even that wording, you know, it wouldn't have been to bring her, you know, the child, or, you know, the adult within that case to where he should be within his education. I think it was more to, I think it was actually awarded more to his mother as a recompense for, she basically came forward and said that she'd done so much work in her life to kind of try and continue to get that education, and that it costed her to do that. So it's definitely a different system. And I know now that I think generally if a case is successful in Ireland, there is redress awarded.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought up that term damages. And I just want people listening to know that in the United States, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, there is no damages. So when I'm talking about compensatory education, it's a different concept, because it would be, if one were successful in getting compensatory education, it would be something along the lines of a bank of services. But it wouldn't be damages in the strict sense, where somebody is paid, a family is paid, or a child is paid money for having been damaged. That's a concept that does not exist under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So I'm really glad you brought that up so that I could point that out. And so, Orla, you know, in what role do the courts play in the tension between students' rights under any type of Irish law or statute concept and not getting them? What role do your courts play in that?
That's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, the judicial branch is not what you would necessarily think of when you think of, you know, the branch of government that would be influential, the most influential, let's say, in creating education policy. But when it comes to special education in Ireland, the courts have had an immeasurable effect, really, on deciding policy. And again, that has kind of come from the fact that they're, due to that lack of kind of statutory provision, due to the lack of guidance, really, from the Constitution, the courts have cases come in front of them on an individual basis. But yet, whatever they decide becomes case law, and it ends up being, you know, applied to the country at large. I mean, I think there was one case, it was the O'Donoghue case, where within the High Court, it was actually set out exactly how many hours of ABA a child should receive, how many hours of OT, how a classroom should be. So there should be 12 students to one teacher. And then that was actually applied as a policy to the rest of the country. Anybody who felt that they fell within that category, which was an inordinate kind of amount of influence to have. But I think following, you know, there was another case, which was again the TD case. And basically, there was a decision from the High Court that was appealed to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically found that there had been a breach of the separation of powers, and that the courts had become too involved in deciding matters of education, because number one, the courts aren't democratically elected. They are not specialized in issues of education. You know, they can't basically tell the executive how to spend their money, because then again, that's kind of causing that breach of the separation of powers. And I think following the kind of the years since, particularly following the Senate case, where, you know, they basically pulled back and they said, okay, we can limit this to 18, because it wasn't simply a matter of, oh, you know, adults can't benefit from primary school education if they haven't received it. It was very much a, we cannot be going overboard with this. It's not our place to tell the government how to execute policy. But they have done anyway, even with kind of that pulling back. Unfortunately, all that's meant is that these more conservative decisions have basically meant for any family looking to invoke their right to education, they're looking at increasingly limited ways of doing it. So the courts are incredibly important, but they shouldn't be the kind of vehicle of change that they have been used as. So I suppose to really, it's just to sum it up, it's just to say that the courts have become very conservative in their judgments when it comes to matters of special education. But considering that they are the only government, you know, branch of government that are actually making any choices or any decisions around this, even though it's conservative, it is still having a huge ripple effect on the rest of any children with special education needs in Ireland, essentially.
Now, in Ireland, do the courts get to choose which cases they will hear and reject cases they don't want to hear? Or does every case that get filed get heard?
I'm actually not sure of the answer to that question. That's a great question. I would imagine that if they're appealed to the Supreme Court, I believe that they do have to be heard, but I wouldn't be sure on that.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you and I will talk another time and we can circle back to that. But just for our listeners here in the United States, in our federal court system, the district court and the courts of appeals, the courts hear the cases that are filed, unless there's, you know, something wrong jurisdictionally, or they dismiss the case for some procedural or substantive matter. But our courts don't get to pick and choose which cases they would like to hear and not hear, except for the United States Supreme Court, which is the highest court in our country. And the United States Supreme Court can pick and choose which cases it wants to hear, and they only hear a limited number of cases per session of when the Supreme Court is active. So here we file cases and they will get heard unless they are dismissed for some reason other than the court isn't interested in hearing it. And just also to be clear for our listeners, with respect to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, these cases, if a family decides to sue a school district, and that's how it works here, you sue an individual school district that your child resides in, that's what we call an administrative level. And then if it were to be appealed in New York, anyway, there's only a few states in our country where we have something called a second administrative tier. In New York, anyway, it would go to some place called the State Review Office. And then if there was a further appeal, it then goes to the federal court, the district court. And then a further appeal after that would go to one of the courts of appeals. And in New York, we are in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which comprises New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. And then if we were to continue to appeal, we would then go to the United States Supreme Court. We would petition the court and ask to be heard, and the Supreme Court would decide whether or not they were going to hear the case. So it's rare that any of our cases get up to the United States Supreme Court, but certainly they have. And circling back to something that you said earlier in our conversation is that you are a common law country, as are we. We too are a common law country, which is also based on the British system. So we have something called stare decisis here, where our cases are decided based on the cases that were decided before and known as precedent. So it is interesting the similarities that we have in our judicial system, and our federal courts, I think, echo the same sentiment as the Irish courts in your opinion, that they don't believe that they are supposed to be making policy or are the educational experts, and they defer to educational experts, which is critical to the cases being won or lost here. Really depends on what the educational experts are saying. Our courts also do not want to be involved in making educational policy here. And we do have a lot of litigation. I think, you know, the United States is a litigious country to begin with. And in the area of special education law, that's no different. But also interesting here is this is a civil rights statute, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And when our country, our government wants to encourage people to enforce their civil rights, and with that comes something called a fee-shifting provision. So in a civil rights statute, and well, especially or definitely with the IDEA, parents can bring these lawsuits against their school district, and if they are successful, the legal fees may be, well, compensated or reimbursed by the school district if the school district ultimately loses that. And there's a whole analysis into what that would look like. It's not necessarily 100 cents on the dollar. There's a lot of analysis that goes into that, but they don't want to have a chilling effect on families. They want families to, they being the government, enforce their child's civil rights with respect to their educational rights under the statute. So this fee-shifting provision is in place to help families to do that. Now, again, if a family were to pursue this and lose, they're not going to be reimbursed their fees, but nor do they have to pay the fees of the school district except under very limited circumstances, which is kind of beyond the scope of this podcast today. But I remember reading your papers, Orla, on this subject, and in Ireland, it's quite different. Could you tell us how it works in Ireland with respect to the cost of litigation?
Right. So I think in the kind of 1990s and the early 2000s, there were so many cases that came before the courts, you know, kind of against the Minister for Education. And these courts were of major constitutional value. And I think they were very successful. And I think then by 2004, the Department of Education had spent 5.1 million euro in legal fees and court settlements, which is obviously quite an expensive venture for them. Now, by 2010, that figure had fallen to approximately 650,000 euros, so quite a drop within 6 years. And then by 2013, the figure fell further to 60,000 for the year. So again, so you can imagine, I mean, falling from 5.1 million to 60,000, you know, in the space of basically 10 years was quite significant. And a lot of people would estimate that the reason for this would be because in 2004, on foot of one of these cases, I believe it may have been actually the Senate case, Mary Hanafin, who was the former Minister for Education, basically came forward and said unjustified claims are an abuse of the legal process and, you know, will be at their own expense and not of the state. And considering that, you know, the costs for different cases can escalate into the millions, you know, I mean, it would be fairly reasonable to think that if there are families who are struggling already and trying their very best to provide for their child, they're not going to risk the idea of going into millions of euros of debt over a case they may not even win. I mean, it was really only the other day I was reading an article about a family who are going to lose their house because they've spent so much money on legal costs. And within Ireland, we do have something called, I'm not sure, maybe it's in the US too, but it's called no foal, no fee. And it's basically the same as pro bono. You know, if you go to court and you don't win, then you're not charged anything. But it's very hard to take pro bono cases when the risks are still so high, depending if you have to pay for the state as well. A lot of journalists who I spoke to basically said they'd done their own investigations and what they had felt was that it really was down to just families being too afraid. But I actually reached out to the Department of Education directly with the Freedom of Information Act request. And I was called off a private number, I remember. I was basically told in no uncertain terms that I was to remove my request, which had basically been asking about this drop in numbers. And I wanted to know exactly how much was being spent by the department on, you know, a settlement unit and a litigation department in regard to this. And they said that they would be very easy, basically, if I didn't officially remove it, they would just cancel it and say that I hadn't filled it out properly. But if I was to be willing to, you know, kind of navigate this with them, then they would send me information, which would not actually answer my questions, but they would send me something. And they did send me something, but it was very cloak and dagger and very telling, I thought, at the time, actually, as well.
Sounds like the makings of a television series, Orla.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Sometimes you just can't make this stuff up. So we're getting close to wrapping this up, and I'm just wondering, you know, what is your greatest hope for Ireland and students with disabilities?
I think there is the Irish people have become very politically engaged within the past few years, and I think that's kind of be seen by different referendums that have been held and different priorities to be seen in government. And I think there is definitely positive movement towards creating a better Ireland, you know, and kind of, you know, bringing ourselves into the, you know, into the lines of different human rights elements and, you know, kind of becoming very modern. I think Ireland at the moment is trying to strike that balance between respecting and honouring things like the Irish language, which is coming back with a vengeance at the moment and is becoming a very trendy thing to be involved with, you know, and very kind of old Irish, but then also bring forward very new elements. I would hope that that continues and that reflects and moves forward to special education provision in Ireland, and that we continue and quite drastically try to move forward and keep up with the rest of the world in terms of where our protections are for children, you know, with special educational needs, who are some of the most vulnerable and marginalised within our country and certainly all over, I would say, as well. So I would hope that we continue to move at a much faster level, but that, you know, we can provide what we've promised that we'll provide, particularly under the Convention of the Rights of the Person with Disabilities. So I would hope that we can implement that as soon as possible, really.
Well, that sounds great. And just one last thing before we wrap up. We touched on it ever so briefly, and we were talking about the terminology in Irish words. I think probably a lot of people listening don't realize that the Irish have their own language, and it's not English. Do you know when?
Right.
At some point, obviously, everybody spoke Irish. Do you know when English became the language of Ireland? And you might not have the date.
I wouldn't have the date, but I would imagine off the top of my head it was probably the 1800s, and maybe even sooner than that, to be honest. I mean, you know, even my granddad would have grown up speaking Irish. So in certain parts of the country, I think the numbers for Ireland would be 40% of people in Ireland can say that they can speak Irish, but it's only 2% of people actually say they do speak Irish on a regular basis. And I'm not sure when those numbers would have drastically fallen off as hard as they have. But I do know that there is a resurgence happening at the moment, and people are trying to commit to using it more and kind of connecting with that ancestral language. And I think the Irish language is the first language of Ireland, as it's within our constitution, and it's a really beautiful language, and it kind of really reveals a lot about how Ireland was and, you know, what used to be valuable. I mean, even I think, just as an example, you know, I recently saw there's a word called you know, a goldfinch. It's a bird, and in the Irish language it would have been called a lasser quilla, which was a woodland flame. And even the fact there's been a new book released recently, and it's called 32 Words for Field, and it's, you know, all these beautiful words that we would have had that meant different things, whereas now in the English language it's kind of lost a little bit. Yeah, so it's definitely, I think it's moving its way forward again, which is great, but I wouldn't know exactly when it fell off or when we started speaking English, but I would say the 1800s.
Well, this has been great, Orla. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate having had this conversation. I think it's just really interesting to compare the systems and how it works in our country compared to other countries. And because New York certainly is so heavily populated with people who have come here from Ireland, I thought it would be interesting to touch on this. And of course, I hope to do more comparative studies with people from other countries as well. But you definitely have sparked my interest in how it works where you are and compared to how it works where we are. And I can't thank you enough for sharing your knowledge with us today, Orla. And I hope you'll join us again on another day.
I'd love to. Well, thanks so much for having me, Tracy. I've been really looking forward to this conversation. So I really appreciate it and learning more from you as well. So thank you.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune into our next episode. And please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. And leave us a review. We love hearing from you.